Sometimes games are played where you try to take things that on the surface don't appear to have anything in common and to try to figure out what the link is. And so this morning I want to put four passages up on the screen and let's figure out what the link to these passages actually is. The first one taken from Exodus 25. Here the writer tells us the instructions of the Lord, you shall put the mercy seat on the top of the ark. And in the ark you shall put the testimony that I shall give you. There I will meet with you, and from above the mercy seat, from between the two cherubim that are on the top of the testimony, I will speak with you about all that I will give you in commandment for the people of Israel. There's entry number one. Let's look at entry number two, coming from the book of Deuteronomy. But in the cities of these peoples that the Lord your God is giving you for an inheritance, you shall save alive nothing that breathes, but you shall devote them to complete destruction, the Hittites and the Amorites, the Canaanites, the Perizzites, the Hivites, and the Jebusites, as the Lord your God has commanded. Verse number 3. Coming from Ezekiel chapter 13. Therefore thus says the Lord God, behold, I am against your magic bands with which you hunt the souls like birds, and I will tear them from your arms, and I will let the souls whom you hunt go free, the souls like birds. And passage number 4 from the book of Psalms says, I hate those who pay regard to worthless idols, but I trust in the Lord. So what's the common link? Very seemingly different verses, from the Ark of the Covenant to the warning about destroying the Canaanites to magic bands on the arms to idolatry. The link is 1 Samuel chapter 4. Because here within this chapter, we find that the children of Israel take the Ark of the Covenant that God had instructed them to have as a remembrance of He in the midst of their camp. They have not destroyed the Canaanites around them, and thus they have learned of their pagan ways. And we know that from time to time, the paganism that surrounded them became a part of their lifestyle, which I believed happened as they began to take those pagan elements of good luck charms and magic bands, and they made the Ark of the Covenant into a good luck charm that simply became an idol to them. And thus, what was to remind them of the Lord and to remind them that they were set apart, they allowed the practices of the nations to encroach on them and to turn this into nothing more than a good luck charm, than a talisman that they could have in their midst that they believed would bring them luck. As we continue in our series on Shiloh, I want us to talk about the events of 1 Samuel chapter 4. So I encourage you to turn there. Just keep your Bibles open there for the majority of the lesson. And as we saw last week with the Ark of the Covenant, so we'll see this week in the idea that these lessons are showing us how they had turned the Lord's worship into something very improper. And even today we'll see how they turned the concept of God into something very improper. But before we get to that, let's make our setting and think about what's going on. The map up on the screen will show you the location of Shiloh. If you look right here, here's Shiloh. Here is where the battle is being fought, somewhere in this general vicinity. So the battle's about 20 miles away from where the Ark of the Lord was, in this little town of Shiloh that had kind of become the religious center of Israel. And the people of Israel have experienced a very bad situation. As Gary explained earlier, they had been defeated by the hands of the Philistines. 4,000 men had lost their lives in that battle that had been given. And so because of that great loss, there is a question that's asked. The elders are going to ask this question, and you note I've got a question mark there because I'm not sure it's the right question to ask. But if you look in verse 3, the troops come in. The elders of Israel said, why has the Lord defeated us today before the Philistines? And I suggest to you there's a question about the properness of this particular question because of the instructions that are going to follow. The elders seem to have missed the introspection they should have been making of looking at themselves and to say, what have we done that's caused this problem? What have we done that has brought this terrible loss upon us. Sadly, whichever question was asked, they answered it very wrongly. And they make a bad decision. Let's actually pick up at the latter part of verse 3. And I want you to note a very slight transition in language that speaks volumes of a very major, major mistake. After asking the question, the elders say, "Let us bring the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord here from Shiloh." And I want you to notice what they say. "That it may come among us and save us from the power of our enemies." Did you notice that? Why has God allowed this defeat to happen? Let's bring the Ark of the Covenant so that it can save us. Continue on in verse 4. "So the people sent to Shiloh and brought from there the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord of Hosts, who is enthroned on the cherubim, and the two sons of Eli, Hophni and Phinehas, were there, and the Ark of the Covenant of God." So here we find this bad decision that's being made, and the two priests, who should have known much better than what was going on here, are seemingly very much willing to allow this to happen. And so, with no objection whatsoever, the two priests are going to allow that ark to go to the battlefield. And not only that, when it arrives at the battlefield, there is great elation over what's happened. Look again at verse 5. "When the Ark of the Covenant came into the camp, all Israel gave a mighty shout so that the earth resounded." I don't know that I've ever been in a situation even comparable to that. Perhaps an SEC football game might be the closest we could think about, where there are times when fans get so boisterous that it can actually register on the Richter scale as a minor earthquake. Maybe that's what we've got going on here, but it's a sign of great zeal, of great enthusiasm and excitement as they see their good luck charm making its way, because now there is nothing that will stand in their way of victory. Or is there? Because as the battle continues on, there is a very different outcome than what they had expected. What do we find as the dominoes begin to fall? Well, first of all, the battle that they thought was sewn up ends in defeat once again. Many more lose their lives. We find that the good luck charm, the thing that was going to come into their midst because it could save them, now goes off into the hands of the Philistines. What a lesson from God that He's giving to them. That not only am I not with you, I'm even going to let my ark not be with you. And thus the ark is captured. Eli, and later we're going to find his sons and his daughter-in-law, all die as a result or in the midst of all of this. And what we find as a result is that what was supposed to save lives is actually going to bring death. The very thing that the people thought would save them is the very idea that they had that's going to cause them to be defeated. And here's the reason. They had no desire to obey God. They only wanted to use Him. And that kind of God can never win a battle. A God who is going to be there only when you want Him is a God who is completely useless. And so with this background in mind, what we understand from all of this is that if they had only listened to what God had told them early on, if they had only read their own law, they would well have understood the reason that they lost this battle. We think about Leviticus chapter 26. In verse 14 through 17, it states, "But if you will not listen to me and will not do all these commandments, if you spurn my statutes and if your soul abhors my rules so that you will not do all my commandments but break my covenant, then I will do this to you. I will visit you with panic, with wasting disease and fever that consume the eyes and make the heart ache. And you shall sow your seed in vain, for your enemies shall eat it. I will set my face against you, and you shall be struck down before your enemies. Those who hate you shall rule over you, and you shall flee when none pursues you." Here's why they lost. God told them, when bad things like this happen, it's because you've refused my commands. You no longer are listening to the things that I have to tell you. So because of that mistake, I want us to learn these lessons from Shiloh. And at the outset, we need to understand that all of the wrongs we are about to see do not make something right. I think what we're going to see in the children of Israel are many of the same things that plague us today as we take an improper view of religion, as we take an improper view of God. That though something is done, perhaps in His name or at least with the idea, wrongs are not going to make something right. So let's begin with the biggest mistake that they made. And that was they had the wrong God. They were not interested in what God really was like. In fact, the Ark of the Covenant should have taught them about this God. The passage we read earlier from Exodus chapter 25 and verse 22 illustrated to them that God desires to be in their midst, that God desires to have this relationship with them. In fact, the tabernacle and later the temple, the Ark of the Covenant, were all illustrations that God is amongst the people. But yet what they failed to realize is that this God had given a covenant and that His staying in their midst depended on their attitude toward Him. And thus what should have taught them this lesson actually led them to create their own concept of God. And so can we. And thus what we find is that He was not then, nor is He now, the God of the box. We might think about this particular attitude very much in relation to a myth that has made it down through many generations, including even a Disney movie. You think about Aladdin and his magic lamp. What's the concept? The concept is, as long as you have the lamp nearby, you've got the power of the genie nearby. Now, depending on what version you read, that's either a good thing or a bad thing, but let's just get the point. It's the belief that you contain something that contains your God, that can give you whatever you desire. And thus, that magic lamp was something sought by all because here was the power. It's exactly how they were viewing the Ark of the Covenant. And in so doing, that's exactly how they were viewing God, as the genie of the bottle, the genie of the lamp, except in this case, the genie of the box. That He was the one who would provide everything that they wanted. I want to show you two or three passages. And I think these will help to illustrate that when God is your God, it does not ensure good luck. It does not ensure that your life, physically speaking, is going to go like you want it to. Let's think first of all from Job. Perhaps one of the most famous verses from the book, Job says, "Though He slay me, I will hope in Him." Does that sound like someone who's bringing you good luck? Does that sound like someone, boy, if I can have him nearby, that's going to ensure me victory and success? Job had some difficulties, but he understood this, that despite all of the bad that was happening to him, he was not going to give up on God. Consider also from the end of the short prophecy of Habakkuk, "Though the fig tree should not blossom, nor fruit be on the vines, the produce of the olive fail, and the fields yield no food, the flock be cut off from the fold, and there be no herd in the stalls, yet I will rejoice in the Lord. I will take joy in the God of my salvation. God the Lord is my strength." You think Habakkuk understood that? You read his short prophecy and you find where he's having to come to that understanding. "Though it looks like everything is going badly, I will rejoice in God." And the apostles themselves understood that. They called in the apostles, they beat them and charged them not to speak in the name of Jesus and let them go. They then left the presence of the council rejoicing that they were counted worthy to suffer dishonor for the name. You see that? Here were people who knew the exact opposite of what the Israelites believed. That they had a God of the box, that they could use Him to win their victories for them. And thus, they had to come to terms with that God is not what they thought. And just like the Israelites, we understand that many can lose their faith because of this. Many will lose their faith because they think perhaps he's this good luck charm who's going to bring them all of these good things. And sadly, there's many false teachers who teach that very thing. Follow God. Prosperity is going to follow that. Who will give up on him? Because at the first outcome of bad, they think God has given up on them. Several years ago, I was having a conversation with a young lady. She had been a Christian, and she had decided now that she was an agnostic. And I was trying to encourage her to overcome some of that, and she made a statement to me that has just, it's just stayed with me through the years. She said, I sat on my bed, and I cried and I prayed all night long for God to give me a sign that He exists. I sympathize with her at that very young age. But do you know what she was doing? She was asking for something that God had never promised to do. She was asking for something that God had never said, I'll do for anyone nor everyone. And I believe she had the same problem the Israelites had. That her God of the box needed to respond in the way she thought he needed to respond. And I assume even to this day she's not overcome that. That still her faith is floundering because of that. Serving God is not a sign that you are going to have physical success. And in fact, we have to understand that even while we're living in this earth, bad things are going to happen. Jesus Himself said, let the wheat and the tares grow together. There are going to be times because of our living on this sin-soaked planet, bad things happen. And we can't allow that to rob us of the faith that we have in God. Now, let me point out one other thing. They also failed to understand that God was not their own personal weapon. The assumption was, well, we've got the ark. Wherever the ark is, God is. If God is here, God ensures victory. Therefore, we're going to gain victory. Now, I'm sure a math teacher could put all of that out and show us the fallacy of that proposition. But how many times do we treat God that way? That we think God is our own personal tool, and if somebody's doing something to us, we can pray hard and heavy for bad things to happen to that person. That can cost faith also. Remember back in the days of Malachi, the people said, it is vain to serve God. What is the profit of our keeping His charge or of walking as in mourning before the Lord of hosts? And now we call the arrogant blessed. Evildoers not only prosper, but they put God to the test and they escape. That's what was going on. Here were people who very self-righteously believed in the God of the box. He ought to be destroying our enemies. They didn't see the enemies being destroyed. They believed that these people who were arrogant and haughty were getting away with it. And they said, well, if God is that way, there's no use serving Him. There's great danger in that. Because God sees a great deal that we do not see. And God understands schedules much better than we understand them. And I want to encourage all of us to be very wary of coming to the point where we believe that we can assign someone's eternal fate. We say, well, God is surely going to send that person to hell. That's not our decision. Now, don't get me wrong. We teach His principles and we warn about the dangers. But it is not our duty to take on the role of punishment, is it? It's not our duty to say because we have the God of the box, we can decide. No, that is completely up to God. So what's our duty? Our duty is to take this word and to teach it and to point out error and to show wrong and to show the right way. But that's where our duty ceases. And thus, it's at those points we remember the words of Romans 12, if your enemy is hungry, feed him. If he's thirsty, give him drink. Why? Because it's what precedes that. Vengeance is mine, says the Lord. I will repay. In other words, you leave that to me. You leave the decisions about punishment in my hands, and you live your life as though here is someone who you can aid and help in their struggles. And if you and I can do that, we avoid that concept of the wrong God, the God of the box, who is either there for our own personal betterment or there for our weapon that we want to get someone. No. We come to an appreciation for who God truly is. Another wrong that we see here in the Israelites is that they had the wrong view of things. And what do I mean by that? What they had done is they had actually created some false synonyms. They had decided that really ritual and spiritual could be used interchangeably. Now, why do I say that? Well, consider what's going on here. As the Israelites are bringing the ark out, I'm going to make a couple of assumptions here, and I don't think they're too far out. I am assuming that they probably carried the ark to the battlefield in the right way. Wouldn't you? What happens when we find people carrying it incorrectly? We find punishment. You remember that with Uzzah. He touched it. That's much later, of course. You remember also that that God had said when the ark comes out, it's to be carried on these poles. Somewhat after this event, not far afterwards, when the men go and they lift the cover off, God strikes them all dead. I'm going to make an assumption that they carried the ark correctly. I'm going to make a second assumption. I'm going to assume that they probably veiled the ark correctly to carry it to the battlefield. So here they are. They're understanding some of that. And let me make a third assumption. I'm assuming that they thought that this would be acceptable. Because had the ark ever been used in battle before? Yeah. Remember Jericho? The ark preceded that battle. But here's the thing. They fail to understand why. They fail to understand the reasoning behind all of this. And they came to the concept of as long as we get the ritual right, everything else is going to be okay. Because ritual and spiritual and spiritual and ritual, they're all about the same anyway. And in that, they could not be farther from the truth. And I'm going to give us all a very stern warning here. It is so easy for us to do the same thing. It is so easy for us to think what is ritual is spiritual and what spiritual is ritual. And we give service to God, but it's only a shell of what it needs to be. We must understand that ritual religion is not spiritually motivated. Let me illustrate this from a passage that records the words of Jesus, John chapter 14 and verse 15. Look at what he says. If you love me, you will keep my commandments. What is the motivation for following Jesus Christ? He gives it. He says, if you love me, you will obey my commandments. Now, let's take part of that out. Let's say we obey the commandments, but we do not have the love of Jesus included. We are obeying the commandments because we've always obeyed the commandments. And our mothers before us obeyed the commandments. And our fathers before us obeyed the commandments. Now let me ask you, what has religion become? I'm doing it because I've always done it. I'm doing it because my family has always done it. Let me make a very profound statement. Religion is not a pattern to be religious. Understand what I mean by that? Religion is not there for the sake of being religious. Obedience, following the commands of God, doing what He says, is the outcome of the love that we have for Him. And if I miss either of those, my religion is pointless. If I am trying to serve God but don't care about His commands, it's pointless. If I don't care about God but I'm trying to serve what He says, it's pointless. Thus, I must not fall into the same trap that they fell into. And I want to warn us, because I think that's one of the greatest dangers that those of us who come from perhaps a fairly long line of family that are Christians, that's exactly the danger we have. that what we have accepted because of family tradition, we continue on for that same reason. That's a danger. And thus our religion is so shallow, we wouldn't get our ankles wet if we waded through it. It cannot be that way. And it's also a danger for those who have been Christians a number of years, that we allow what is somewhat commonplace to us to become just that common, and to do it for the sake of doing it. That cannot be our attitude. Thus, ritual religion is not spiritually motivated. In that same vein, ritual worship is not spiritual worship. What did Jesus say as he was talking about those in the book of Mark where they are just very shallow in their worship? He said to them, "Well did Isaiah prophesy of you hypocrites, as it is written, 'This people honors me with their lips, but their heart is far from me. In vain do they worship me, teaching as doctrines the commandments of men.'" Here were people who had no respect for God. They were including their own thoughts on par with His. And thus Jesus says, "Their worship to me is vain." Now, that doesn't mean it can't be orderly. That doesn't mean we've got to come in here and every Sunday morning is a surprise of what we're going to do. No, we can have order. And we can have structure. Just as long as that doesn't become our God. Just as long as three songs and a prayer doesn't become our God. I have not noticed this here, but in previous places, I guess every place that I preached beforehand, there were people who would come on Sunday morning only for the Lord's Supper. They would show up about 10 o'clock. They would leave about 20 after 10. Every Sunday, week in, week out. What did their religion become? It's a ritual. What had happened? These weren't people who were disabled. These weren't people who were on up in years who had problems sitting still. These were people who said, "I'm going to give the ritual." And we just cannot do that. My worship must not be motivated because it's something for me, for what I want to get out of it. It cannot be motivated because of safety, because I want to appease some angry God. Worship, religion must all be for His glory. And that's what Israel missed. That's why they lost the battle. And that's why the warning is there for us. Let me mention as well, they had the wrong priest, didn't they? Hophni and Phinehas, we already know about their lifestyle from 1 Samuel chapter 2 and verse 12. If you're still here, back up just a page or so in your Bible. Now I want you to read what's said about the priest of God. "The sons of Eli were worthless men." That's bad enough, isn't it? But then read, "They did not know the Lord." Isn't that horrible? Here were men who had been commissioned to give God the glory and lead Israel in the right direction, and the text says they didn't even know Him. They had failed to understand their instructions. Deuteronomy 33:10. "They, the priest, shall teach Jacob your rules and Israel your law. They shall put incense before you and whole burnt offerings on your altar." The priests were very important men. Here were men who were to instruct Israel in the ways of righteousness. Here were men who are responsible for the worship of God. And what we find in Hophni and Phinehas are two men who were only interested in themselves. And thus, their personal interest, motivated by their desire for the popular idea, led them to consent to allow this to happen. I'm going to tell you what should have happened. Hophni and Phinehas should have stood in front of that ark and said, "Over our dead bodies." Israel might have obliged. However, that is exactly what they were responsible for. The ark was theirs to take care of. And they completely flittered that away. Why? Because of their own interest. Because of the popular notion of the time. We got to beware of that also. We need to understand that it's oftentimes easy to give in to the crowd. It's oftentimes easy to give sway to the crowd for two reasons, either for our own personal gain or for our own safety. This morning, as we finished up our study here in the auditorium, we were talking about the book of Jude and those warnings to false teachers. Why did they get so out of bounds? It was for this reason. They either wanted their own glory in all of this, or they wanted to maintain the safety of their position and thus go with the crowd. And because of that, that's what Hophni and Phinehas did. I want to remind you of what we read over in the book of 1 Peter. And as we do that, consider the idea of priestly credibility. And we'll come back to that point here in just a second. Listen to what 1 Peter says, though, chapter 2. Peter says, "You are a chosen race, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, a people for His own possession." Why? "That you may proclaim the excellencies of Him who called you out of darkness into His marvelous light. Once you were not a people, but now you are God's people. Once you had not received mercy, but now you have received mercy. Beloved, I urge you as sojourners and exiles to abstain from the passions of the flesh, which wage war against your soul. Keep your conduct among the Gentiles honorable, so that when they speak against you as evildoers, they may see your good deeds and glorify God on the day of visitation." I realize Peter is using the term priest as it was applied to the nation of Israel. The lesson is nonetheless there. The same thing that Hophni and Phinehas should have been doing is what we better be doing. That's taking our position responsibly, making sure that we are staying steadfast to the ways of God, proclaiming His excellency and not our own, ready to give an answer to those who are against God. That's what we do. Because priestly misconduct gives credibility to wrong. Hophni and Phinehas, by their consent, gave credibility that the priests of God were on board with this. And when you and I go off into error, when you and I go off and do things wrong, we're doing the exact same thing. We must make sure that we are obeying God because He is God, and not falling sway to anything else. Well, finally, the final wrong that we see is the wrong kind of zeal. The army had the wrong reaction. They saw the Ark of the Covenant come in, and what happened? The thunderous roar of acceptance and approval. Do you think Jericho may have been in their minds? I wonder. You think they thought back to that time as the people marched around the walls and those walls fell, that if they could just get that ark in their midst, the Philistines would fall before them as those walls of Jericho? Whatever their reasoning, they were motivated, but they failed to understand that their zeal would not bring victory. They illustrated what many times we tend to think. And that's that if someone is excited about something, then that something must be right. That if it's producing enthusiasm and excitement and zeal, then it must be right. I tell you, walk into any of the mega churches today and you will see that very thing. It is built on enthusiasm. It is built on a zealous response. But zeal does not ensure correctness. Zeal does not make what is wrong right. Remember the words of the Apostle Paul? "Brothers, my heart's desire and prayer to God for them is that they may be saved. For I bear them witness that they have a zeal for God, but not according to knowledge." The zeal was there, but the knowledge was missing. That's a recipe for disaster every time. So what do these wayward Israelites teach us? They teach us how easy it is to have the wrong God and the wrong view and the wrong priest and the wrong zeal. And as we conclude these thoughts, I want us to go back to the words that were spoken by Eli's daughter-in-law. It says, "About that time of her death, the women attending her said to her, 'Do not be afraid, for you have borne a son.' But she did not answer or pay attention, and she named the child Ichabod, saying, 'The glory has departed from Israel, because the ark of God had been captured, and because of her father-in-law and her husband.' And she said, 'The glory has departed from Israel, for the ark of God has been captured.'" H.L. Ellison had this to say, He said, the words at her death are touching, but she is wrong. The glory of God had indeed departed, but not because the ark of God had been captured. The ark of God had been captured because the glory had already departed. And that's what you and I must understand. That God doesn't come to us on our terms. If He were that kind of God, He would be so weak. He would be a God that none of us would want to follow, who mollycoddles and changes depending on whatever whim or wish someone has. He's not the God of the box. He is the God of heaven. And I hope He's your God.